Hello, welcome to episode number 288 of the Apolog Podcast. I am your host, Simon Head. This podcast is brought to you in part by AIXDSP.com. Get affordable and useful plugins. Get the IC Intuition Compressor. It's a compressor that gives you a clear and intuitive visual display that shows exactly what is happening to your audio at all times. Click the link in the description for more information. Amazon shoppers, link is back. The click-through is back. Well, I can't call it click-through, but it's back. You can check the link in the description or go to apolog.ca and click on those banners located on the right side. It's only Canada right now, but, you know, whatever. We'll see how this goes because Amazon's kind of changed some rules on me and they stole money from me. So I'm just being very, very wary of what Amazon can do. So shop, you know, it doesn't cost you any money and you're not going to lose anything. But, you know, if something happens, I lose the commission. It's on me. No big deal. It costs you no extra money. It supports the show. Thank you so much for doing that. Whoever's been doing that, I appreciate that. You can also support my work by going to patreon.com/apolog. You can pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with my hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel at any time. Buy a t-shirt, apolog.ca/shop. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show. Give it 5 stars, please, on iTunes. Like and share on Facebook by going to facebook.com/apologpod. Follow me on Twitter at SimonHead666. What can I say about today's guest? Today's guest is none other than Mr. Elliot Lefko. Elliot and I have known on and off each other for almost 30 years. Elliot has been the integral part of the Canadian independent music scene in the Toronto in the 80s. He used to run clubs. He's a promoter. He moved down to LA and started working for Golden Voice, which is one of the largest, one of the larger promotion companies in America. And now he's back home. I think he's working from home right now like everybody else. And the thing I love about this podcast, this episode, not one COVID mention. Not one. Maybe a little snippet at the end of it because I actually made note that there's no COVID conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Elliot Lefko on the Apolog Podcast. I came up in the 90s, and I think you're in 80s to the 90s, aren't you?
Yes.
Did you always live in Toronto?
Yes, I always lived in Toronto. I was born there, and I lived there my whole life. And I probably started doing shows when I was 25, so 68, 78, so probably mid-80s. That's when I started doing shows.
Yeah. Were you part of the Illicos, that part of that club? Were you part of that for a while?
Well, that was one of the clubs where I worked at in Toronto. Yeah. There was many different clubs over the years, but that was one of them. And I have fond memories of that place. It was also called The Bridge, too.
Yeah.
And it was managed by Enzo. And he has a long history in Toronto, too. He worked with this guy called Sean Pilot for a long time. And then Enzo ran that club. They were very into rock and roll. That was like the heart of what they tried to do. So it was very fitting to work there because there wasn't many rules. And the funny thing was when I remember doing a gig at Ildikos, which was the 10,000 Maniacs. And it was one of the first times that I had like a really big group. And I was so naive about what I was doing. And they had just started. It was their first time in Toronto, probably their first tour. And they got to the gig and they said, where's the monitor system? And I had no idea what that was. And they looked at me like I was crazy, like they couldn't believe it. And within the next hour, I had to quickly learn about a monitor system, try to find one, bring it there, and put the show on. And I did one other gig with them, but they just thought that I was totally unprofessional, didn't have it together. But again, when you're doing all these bands at the Bridge, like all these hardcore bands at Ildikos, you didn't need a monitor system. And those EDs, you didn't. What was professionalism and what wasn't professionalism?
Yeah.
It was a different sort of side of the coin in terms of what you were looking at.
There's more to break. There's more to break with the monitor system.
Yeah, exactly. There's some, everything starts to get fancy and it's an add-on and an add-on. But at the core, really, I guess what everyone's looking at is the performance of a band and if they're good or not, and everything else is extra. I mean, I know you got to sound really good too, but I always just enjoyed like whether the band could play well or not well, and whether they were just a good band or not a good band.
Yeah. Now, did the sort of like the attitude of the band, did that help or hurt, like you with booking them? Say helping meaning, I really like this band, but maybe they're not the best band in the world, but I like them as people. But this, or the other way around, is I really hate this band, but I know they can make my club money. Did you ever sort of find yourself tipping that line between that, you know, that border, that bridge of sorts?
Well, I guess I was fortunate that for the most part then, and probably over the years, I still got to work with people that I like to work with. And that's really been kind of, especially like these days, is I always choose to work with who I want to work with. Now, I've worked with probably like some bands over the years that that I didn't like, but you know, fortunately, it really wasn't too much. And I remember even I did this gig with Michael Bolton once, and he was just such a nice guy to work with. The people around him, that it was like such a pleasure doing the gig. Obviously, I wouldn't go home and listen to Michael Bolton, mm-hmm. but it's just yeah. I think as long as people respect you, you respect them, then everything just goes so much easier after that.
Yeah, I always find it good through the years when I gravitate towards people who have a similar, not ethic, but I guess a similar understanding of what reality is when it comes to music and business, you know? I'm sure over all the years you've met so many cool people, but I bet you there's a dollar ratio between, you know, well, the show's going to make a lot of money, so I can put up with their prickness for a little while, you know, maybe that.
Yeah, there's sometimes, like they say, you should book with your head and not with your heart.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can't help it. And there's been many gigs over the years where I've done that. One time I brought in Rufus Thomas and his daughter Carla Thomas from Memphis. And they were famous for part of the early Stax music. They were one of the first people who were part of that sound. And Rufus had a big hit with Walking the Dog, and Carla had Gee Whiz. So these are like excellent, amazing soul artists that now people write books about it, et cetera. But at the time when I brought him into Toronto to do a gig, just there definitely was not enough money to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the night, I couldn't pay for it. I had to go to the club owner and just beg him to help me, give me some money so I can pay the band at the end of the night. So it's always, sometimes it doesn't equate to the dollars and the type of people that you have on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always have an appreciation of people who stick their neck out to put shit on stage. You know what I mean? Like, you've done that all these years, and you know, in the early days, that's sort of like the early days of when you came up. There must have been a time where you're like, you know what, I'm gonna go get a quote unquote real job, or I'm gonna go find something else to do. Is there like a tipping point with all that?
I know my parents were always kind of wondering what it is that I did, and always trying to give me money to go to law school, to go take a test to become a lawyer. And there were times when I even probably went to sit in one of those rooms, but I never could do anything like that. This was the only thing that I could do, and I could always do it well. And I never looked at the clock when I was booking gigs. It was always just fun. Again, like having a straight job and trying to make that work just wasn't for me. But this is something I found that I was really good at. I can kind of estimate how many people are going to come in advance for the most part, and that kept me alive. I was reading this old article when I was younger, and I brought in William Burroughs, the writer from Naked Lunch, to do a gig in Toronto. And at the time, I was telling the writer that it was $2,000. It was all my life savings. And I was going to put it all on the line and see what happens. And hopefully it would work. And hopefully I would make enough money that I could continue to do more shows in the future. And fortunately, it did work. And I was allowed to tell more stories after that.
Yeah, that's always the plight of the promoter. It's always like, okay, and not like you say, book with your heart, head, not your heart. It is very, it's hard to get sort of, but for me to bring my favorite band to town, I don't know if I would have that type of conviction to do that type of thing. I think I'd rather pay the ticket price and go see the band, you know?
Yeah, I never really worried about that. And perhaps because I never had that much money, but even when I only had a little bit of money, I was worried that I would lose it. There were times though, when I first started, and I had a little apartment on St. George in Toronto, and there was one time when I definitely ran out of money and I couldn't pay the bands anymore. And they cut my phone off. And I had a friend across the street, this guy, Greg D, he's a hairdresser, also a musician, totally cool guy. And I would go over to his house, use his phone, and he would give me like food to eat. And But I had to call up the agents at one point and just say, like, I'm out of business for a little while until I can get it together. And a lot of them realized that it wasn't the first time they'd ever seen anything like that before. So they gave me a lot of latitude and they said, come back when you're ready and we'll do it again. But at the time, I remember there was this band I wanted to do and it was called Tackhead. They were like a famous British band and experimenting with a lot of new kind of sounds. And it was $3,500 for the show. And I sold like 10 tickets and I had to cancel the gig. And it's just like everybody afterwards was saying, I can't believe it. Like, what a great band. And I said, I know, like, I thought that I was going to bring in this cool thing and I wasn't about the money. But yeah, again, like sometimes your dreams are just, they're too big at the time.
Yeah, that's true. That's, and I, I, you know, I know the shows you've put on over the years. There's that, it's funny we're talking about your parents. My parents didn't know what I did for the first 10 years of my career too. And it was fun to explain because they'd be like, and you do what? And how does that work out for you? And it was like not condescending, but it was also one of those, they just, parents of my generation went to work, got jobs, had kids, retired, you know? And I think like there's a generation of just like, we're just going to see where it goes. We're going to try to, and do our best, follow our dreams. And I think that's sort of a difference between my parents and say us being parents is that we're willing to let our kids sort of possibly take the plunge of sorts where my parents were like, I think you should probably be safe. Take it easy.
Yeah. Being a parent right now, I know I'm way more lenient than my parents were in terms of many things. And then the way you bring up your kid and you don't want to be too hard on them. And then I think that I'd like to give my kid like a lot more freedom and sort of see how it goes and just try to really be there for them.
Yeah. Now, do you have like, is there still a little bit of your parents in you that might come out from time to time and speak logic, or is that, have you pushed that away?
Yeah, well, fortunately, my son goes to a university right now, so it's good. But I just think, like, when I was in school, all I cared about was music. And it's all I wanted to do as far as, like, the business side of music. And I didn't want to go to class, and so I went to York University for, like, 5 years. And I'd go watch the movies at the film courses, and I'd write some articles for the student newspaper. But I couldn't write an essay to save my life. I barely finished school, so it just wasn't for me. It was always like I knew what I wanted was just to be involved with rock and just to make a living in that side of the business.
Yeah. What years was the York University?
I went there from probably like 75, 74, and I was there for like 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And it was great because while I was there, I was going to see shows. And even before that, I remember going down to Massey Hall and seeing Lou Reed, and I lived in the north part of Toronto. So I would take a bus from the suburbs down to Massey Hall downtown and go see Lou Reed or go see Genesis or go see Yes. And those were just my formative years as far as seeing all those kinds of bands and really enjoying it. I really also got off on the whole folk music scene. There was a scene in Toronto on Yorkville Street before it became all commercial. At the time, there was a club called the Riverboat, and they used to have artists like Phil Oakes and Gordon Lightfoot, and just before that it had like Neil Young and Joni Mitchell, but I kind of caught the tail end of it and I just loved it so much. Mm-hmm. Just to be so close to somebody playing guitar and singing, and just it was, everything was so real about it. And and then I would see like Bob Dylan's album cover with him with his warm coat in on the streets of New York with his girlfriend, and I definitely wanted to be that.
Yeah. Did you play music at all?
I always tried. I just never could. I wasn't coordinated for that. But the thing is that you need both sides. You need the musician and you need the business side of it. Yeah. And I think we complement each other in terms of what we do.
I totally agree. I 100% agree. I think when commerce and art kind of cross lines, that is the magic as far as I'm concerned, is being able to navigate yourself through being an artist, as well as understanding what the part of commerce means. It is a tricky road to follow, like especially today, because you have people who are their own managers and they promote their own music and they go through social media, but they might be really good at you know, I have always had a fear of people who are really good and artists having not being very good at holding a conversation, because that's not really what an artist's job was at one point, right? It was about being an artist. So now that today is you're going to wear many hats in the music business, how do you think people are coping with that type of change?
Well, I know that my job is like, I'm like the man as far as like the man who's paying at the end of the night, the artist. And it's hard to be friends with the artist, because you have to keep some sort of distance and some sort of like, there's something, they're looking at you to do a job and they want you to do the job as efficiently as possible. So that means like, you got to pay them. You got to make sure that the production is right at the show. You got to make sure all the marketing is done for the show. And just, again, different than when I was 25 years old and I didn't know what a monitor system was. I can't do that anymore. Now I got to be really have it together, and at the same time, come up with a lot of really good ideas for the musician. And that way they kind of work with me. And some of the people that I work with, they'd be my heroes. Like when I work with Leonard Cohen or I work with Nick Cave, those people are like heroes. But at the same time, you have to lose that hero worship type thing when you're going to sit in the room with them and try to answer their questions about what they're looking for. And to make sure that if you're going to be the man, that you're going to be the man who's like for them. It's like hiring like the lawyer who's really mean. You want to have the mean lawyer working for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right. Leonard Cohen wouldn't have hired you because you're a fan of Leonard Cohen. There's a lot of fans of Leonard Cohen out there. You know what I mean? Like they need somebody that to sort of have their eye on the game and not get starstruck. Yeah. Because I don't work in that level of the business. I work with friends. And I love the friends I work with. And so for me, I've taken a different path because I want to still create and I still want to work in the business. But the ruthlessness of it all is it can be unnerving. You know, you need to have a thick skin.
Yeah, there is definitely a ruthlessness that goes on. And fortunately for me, it's only maybe part of the time, and that there's so many other times when you're dealing with such great people that you're working with, whether it's a musician or a manager or some of the other people in the business. And I've had long relationships with people over the years that I've kept. And part of the fun is going to the show and seeing the music or hearing a song, and the other parts are the interaction you have with people. Mm-hmm. And even with, I remember working with like Marilyn Manson, and I knew his manager really well. We had such good times, and Manson would just be so wild on stage and even backstage and everything. There was always like drama going on, but his manager and I would just look at each other and say, we've seen all this before and we'll see it again. And you don't really get ruffled by seeing it. And you just kind of know that, like, just try to have some fun with it.
Did you work with Matt Cohen?
Yeah. So Matt and I worked for like such a long time because, when I first started off, I was just working by myself.
Yeah.
And then Matt was the production manager eventually for me. But at the time, the production manager was a thankless job. And maybe at the end of the night, I'd give him $20. And then if the show didn't go well, I'd ask him for part of that back. So I could go eat the next day. And he had to take a lot of abuse from the bands at the time, because it's such a threadbare type of a situation. It was just him trying to deal with everybody and doing the best he can. And some of the riders that he would have to get for people would just be like so crazy. And people like, there was this performance poet called Karen Finley, and he'd have to get some supplies for her, and My Life with a Thrill Kill cult. So he'd have to go in places where he normally wouldn't go. It was so funny. It was really funny. The things that he had to go through. And he had this briefcase. And Dave Bookman, a friend of mine, he passed away a couple years ago.
He's a good man.
He was a great guy. And we used to laugh about Matt and his briefcase, because he would just carry that briefcase around trying to look professional. And but it would be like swimming in this pile of, it wasn't a place to look professional, but he was trying his best. And unfortunately, he was around and I was able to depend upon him. I remember the show we did with Danzig. It was at the Concert Hall in Toronto. And it was one of the first big gigs that I did. And with Danzig, you had to bring in this giant cross and to put onto the stage. So it was like Matt Cohen and like five or six roadies. And the roadies were basically just friends of his. And they just had to drag this giant cross across Yonge Street into the concert hall and try to get it up on stage. It was like a comic of errors, an error of comics.
Yeah. Although I think though we cross paths. It would have been at a Marilyn Manson concert. Matt was the production manager, and me, myself, and Johnny Bordanko were runners on this con in the show. And I remember there was one confusion where the caterers thought Matt was getting the booze, and Matt thought the caterers were getting the booze. And all of a sudden, Matt throws like I don't know how many hundreds of dollars and go to the liquor store and go buy everything on this list. And I drove all the way up to the DuPont liquor store, and I was like frantically buying a super amount, huge amount of booze. And I drove out, got all the way back and put it in. It was a varsity arena, and we put it in the room just as the band was walking in. It was like, okay, we narrowly escaped that one. It might have been a show you were working because it was. Is Varsity Arena Marilyn Manson? There's not too many times Marilyn Manson's played Varsity Arena.
Yeah, it was funny because that place was it definitely brings back good memories. It was a hockey arena. It's no longer there now,
Yeah.
and it was part of the University of Toronto, and it held like 5,000 people. So it was one of those places where once the band had gotten past the clubs, once they'd gotten past like 1800 at the concert hall, this was like the next big thing that they were going to do, an arena, but a small arena before they would go to, say, play, if they ever got that big, to play Maple Leaf Gardens or a place like that. And this place was so horrible sounding, this room, because it wasn't made for concerts, it was made for hockey. But I got to, for me, it was getting onto that next level, which was really the big level, and getting to do like Manson there, or there was the Porno for Pyros played there. I think the Beastie Boys played there. I think at one point Nirvana was going to play there, but they didn't. They just missed that step, went to the next step. But many, many good gigs were there. Yeah, it was same thing with Porno for Pyros. The guy wouldn't go on stage without this like amazing bottle of wine, which we didn't have. So we sent someone to his hotel, and he gave him his room key. He ordered the bottle to his room, something like that. And then he brought the bottle to the gig and gave it to Perry Farrell. But yeah, I mean, sometimes it was not that we were concert promoters. It felt like we were waiters, just getting people drinks, whether it was like at Lee's Palace, trying to get your way through 500 people to bring a case of beer to the back room for the band, or whether it was what you were doing, or whether it was for Perry Farrell. But yeah, it was just like we were bringing people drinks and food and towels, and we were glorified busboys.
Yeah, catering people. That's yeah, that's I know the feeling because I have been on the small level of that, getting riders and stuff like that, and working with promoters to get the rider, and usually the best way to get it was sort of say, oh, could you just do that? But I'm sure you've had a lot of people with their fingers in your face going, this has to happen or this won't happen.
Yeah, there's all those kinds of people. I mean, you mentioned Johnny Bordanko, and it's funny how, like, when you mentioned parents, that there is no school for this kind of job. There may be at this point, but at the time there wasn't a school, and you
Yeah.
kind of just had to learn it yourself based on your intuition and your love of music. And people like Johnny would rise through the ranks from being a fan to doing the low level jobs, and then eventually trying to become a promoter himself. And then I look around, and when my kid was at going through school, the parents were like lawyers or doctors or writers of films or whatever, but there was no concert promoters. That just
Yeah.
like wasn't a job that anybody else had. So it was kind of cool because it made me like a little bit different.
Yeah.
And then I looked at like other people over the years who've done this job, like in the Garys in Toronto, and he was a he liked films. He started off showing films, and then there was this woman named Jill Heath, and
I know Jill really well. Yeah.
right, so
Yeah.
she used to put on punk shows. She lived in Oakville with her parents, and somehow she knew the punk bands. And this was at the beginning when Black Flag was just starting to
Yep.
create a series of like, okay, there's this guy in this city, and this guy in this city, and this woman in this city, and I'll go there, and somehow they'll put on a gig, they'll rent a hall, they'll do something. And there was no money, there was barely any stage or production. And Jill would put these gigs on with all those early punk bands like Black Flag and some of the bands from DC. And how did she learn how to do it? How did she do it? How did she juggle doing 50 shows a year with no money and living at her parents? How did all of us do this?
Yeah.
It was great that it all happened.
There was a guy out in Guelph, Aaron Riches, who put on like a Fugazi show at the what was it? Was it was the the RPM, the larger place, whatever, the warehouse.
Right.
So they wouldn't let anybody promote Fugazi unless it was Aaron who put them on in Guelph like the year before. And Aaron was like, he was a promoter at the Trashteria. You know what I mean? And he gets this big break, you know, and Fugazi, you're like, you know, one of his favorite bands. I can imagine. And they, you know, Fugazi would always play without the, they would never turn the show lights on. They'd always have the house lights on when they played. Very punk rock.
Yeah. I mean, the way that they operate then and the way that Ian MacKaye operates, yeah, where you charge $5 or $6 and the lights are on and everybody's got to be respectful to each other. It was just such a great way of doing business. And again, there was like somebody there who created it from nothing and created his own rules around him and had a lot of integrity, and he's still around. And it's nice when people are like that, Louis. You talked before about how that people have that respect for each other, and people like that, it's fortunately there's more people like that than there are the people who are like in your face about get this for me right now.
Yeah, no, I bet. And the network, did you find like a difference between, say, 30 years ago and to like maybe even 20 years ago? It seemed like there was a shift in, especially with the tech world, where it wasn't just all about fanny packs and ponytails. It was about like getting into the networking part of being a technician for bands, or the networking part. It sort of turned into a nice guys game. Did you feel that, or is that just me? Because I felt it.
Well, I think when I first started, that there was a network out there in Canada, at least where I was from, that there were promoters in Montreal and then in around this area, like London, Ontario, and Hamilton. And so sometimes when I'd bring a band in and they'd need an extra gig besides just coming to Toronto, so I would phone up and try to get a network of people out there in these different places, and they would meet them and they would take care of the bands in these other cities. And we were all kind of just doing it the same way, just from the love of music and trying to get some publicity happening, trying to find some people to come out to these gigs so these bands can play for people. Mm-hmm. And it was, and then I love bringing bands in from like across Canada, from Vancouver with Slow and No Means No and yeah, all these kind of bands. And then in Edmonton with some of the bands like Junior Gone Wild. And then there were really bands like from every part of the country that I would bring in, like from Halifax had that whole scene with Sloan and then Thrush Hermit and all these different bands in Jail and Montreal with the Asexuals and the Nils. So I found that it was such a rich time in music when there were so many bands coming from all over Canada.
Yeah. To Toronto.
Yeah. Toronto where I was working, but it just, it seemed like there was never a problem as far as getting bands. And at the time that there were so many great bands coming from Canada. And then I would bring in bands from like all over America and Europe too. But, it was definitely a rich time in Canada. I was listening to, I got my turntable back recently and, some of my old records. So I was listening to the, Asexuals today, and just like, what a great band. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of Canadian history and a lot of bands, and definitely that sort of bridge between Winnipeg and Toronto is always a tricky one to get shows. There was Crocs and Rolls, and I don't even think there was a place to play in Sault Ste. Marie at the time in the 90s when we used to tour out there. I moved out to Winnipeg and joined a band called Red Fisher, and I think we played maybe 6 or 7 times in Toronto. There was definitely like people like Jill. Jill took me on one of my first tours ever as a sound guy with Mal Havoc. I was their front of house sound guy, and they were an interesting group to tour with. Normal dudes, but on stage chaotic.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about metal, or you talk about hardcore, but especially. On stage, the level of intensity is so strong and so hard. And then off stage, most of these people, how's it going? Just take it easy. Like you're just talking to people. And they may have dressed differently with tight black jeans and the long hair over their face and really skinny. And I love metal because like metal brought in a whole different sort of atmosphere as far as like, there was a background story to it, almost like Lord of the Rings, and that fantasy type aspect put together with music together, that was so good. And then hardcore just had like this great intensity on stage that was just so much fun to be in the audience and listen to this kind of music. It was, and again, like hardcore had its whole, all its own rules, its own way of doing things. And that stayed even later on, like, I'd say about 10 years ago, I did this giant gig with Rise Against. It was probably their biggest gig ever in Long Beach, California. And they headlined Descendants for a Support Act when the Descendants just got back together again. And it was, they still could have been like these kids back wherever they came from playing in some small club. They still had that same kind of earnestness about them. And the audience had that same earnestness about them. And it's just that everything was multiplied because these bands had gotten big all of a sudden. But I love you talked like the singer of Rise Against, just like what a cool guy. Same thing like Ian MacKaye. They both just share this love of music, love, appreciation of that they're part of this whole scene and where they came from before and who the people before and the people after them and how much they love the audience. I think they really did appreciate the fact that they had this role.
Yeah. Stefan and I are old friends from the 90s. He produced a band I played in out of Toronto. We were called Trigger Happy. And so we've been friends ever since. And I did two shows with the Descendants, and we were playing Montebello Rock Festival. And the singer from Lamb of God, I have no idea who this guy is. He comes up to me and goes, "Are the Descendants here yet?" I'm like, "Yeah, they're just sleeping, hanging out." Like, okay, really? Okay, because I really want to. He's like the biggest super fan ever of the Descendants. But when you see Lamb of God, it's got, you know, it doesn't sound anything like the Descendants, but he was the biggest fan ever, but he looked like sort of like this dirty old, you know, kid, you know what I mean? From the streets. But he was, you know, it's deceiving. That's what you were saying, is it's deceiving on how people are. You can look at them and go, yeah, they're just into metal and stuff, but there's some really, you know, it's, I'm sure you know it. You meet somebody for the first time and you got to go, and then you got to go, oh, okay, they're okay. They're good people.
Yeah. You mentioned the Rockfest. That Alex, the fellow who started that.
Martel, yeah.
So he started that basically in his bedroom.
He was like 17. 17. Yeah.
17. So he just loved music so much, and he was just really, really smart guy, a real wizard. And he started this thing and did it in his backyard, and it worked. And then every year he just kept growing it and growing it until finally, like the year I went, it was just this giant park and just tens of thousands of people. And he was able to mix music really well together, where it was a little bit of everything in his own world of like metal, hardcore, rock, and then just a lot of different types of music together. And it was by water. So the bands would come, they'd put them in a boat, they'd take them right up to they'd land, and then they'd go into the dressing rooms. And Alex really took care of them. The sad part for him was that it got away from him eventually, and he listened to too many people, and they guided him and said, "You should be bringing in this band and that band." And then all the bands, like the really big bands, started to take advantage of him and asking for too much money. And it got away from him, and he went bankrupt. And he's back now, and he's starting the thing all over again. But it just, it's too bad because his love of music was so good.
The first time I met him is with the Descendants, and he drives up, and he looks like he's a kid, you know, and he's the he's the guy. He's the guy. I meet him for the first time. Immediately, "Hey man, how you doing?" He's like, I'm good. He had all his buddies helping him too, who were also really good at their jobs. And it was the year before they moved the stage to the other side. I think the stage was closer to the water by the end, but at first the stage was closer to the road. And we'd sort of hang out at the hotel and come in and down. And it was just like, his mom paid me cash. Like, and his dad put up snow fence to stop people from breaking into the thing. And when you say it got away, it really did get away with him. At one time, I think he didn't have enough bathrooms, and there was like pissing everywhere, and he just had a horrible experience. And then he got a major corporate sponsorship, which I think was sort of the beginning of people telling him what to do, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's people put on these festivals, and it's kind of the easiest way of losing all your money is by putting on a festival, because you think that, okay, this is great. I can choose all the bands. I don't have to be told what bands to bring in. And if I get so many people, I'll make so much money. But it never really works out that way.
No, because once you've paid everybody, it you find out amazing like how expensive to run these things, especially when you don't consider there's certain things that people never consider. Like I would never consider. You know what I mean? That's why I would probably lose everything if I tried to do a festival. But like I said, it comes back. I really do appreciate when people take that risk and when it works for them. Like, he built that out of nothing, you know, and I always love that part, whether it be music or business, or I love it when people take something from nothing and turn it into something massive, or can keep doing it, because that's the tricky part too.
It is. You always want to wish that people like that who have their dreams that they'll fulfill it. And then it's good for all the bands too, because so many of these bands are playing in clubs. And I used to do these shows with the hardcore bands, and it'd be like in a basement, and it'd be like 7 feet tall, and you'd be hitting your head on the pipes. And it was just like a gross way of doing the shows. I mean, it was the best we could at the time, but it's nice when you could go outdoors and you have a big stage and there's 20,000 people there. And all of a sudden a band like the Descendants or whomever the band is just seeing themselves 10 feet tall instead of like being a midget on stage below some pipes that could break and have water on your head. And it was, as a promoter of outdoor shows, you can be sure that when you wake up that morning and you pull the blinds, that it'll be raining. Like, no matter what it was the day before or the day after, that day it will be raining. And once it starts raining at a festival, then it just totally kills the buzz.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Did you do much at Molson Park back in the Molson Park days? Or were you, was that... Like, what company did you... You started your own company. Did you work for MCA Concerts? Or am I making that up?
Yeah, so I worked on my own for many years, probably from, like, 25 to 35. And then at some point, I got hired by MCA Concerts when they started in Canada. So it was MCA Concerts. They gave me my first gig. And they were owned by Molson's. And Molson's had Molson's Park. Yeah. So at the time, it was... before that... there would be like some gigs that CFNY would put on there. And once Molson's owned MCA Concerts, and they asked us to put some shows there. And the good part was Lollapalooza, because that was at Molson Park. It was probably the first year was somewhere else. And the second year was
CNE Grandstand the first
year. That was it Jane's Addiction. So the second year that I was involved in, and I got to do all the shows after that. It was amazing. They would, the lineups were great. And Molson Park was the kind of place where it held 25,000 people. So there was room for everybody to come. It was all open, and it was a nice place to do shows. And just, they couldn't bring in all the, Lollapalooza couldn't bring in all their crafts to the shows because they got stuck at the border. And so they asked me to do that for them. So I would go and get crafts, get different artists, and, put all that stuff in, and all the people who would have like political information booths. So I'd get all that stuff together and have that all there ready when Lollapalooza came in. And they loved it because it had a Canadian feel to it. And it made it way more of an atmosphere besides just going to see whoever the band was on stage, that you could walk around and you could check this on, check that on. And I remember like the artist I Brain Eater from Vancouver at the time, really kind of great Canadian artist, and reaching out to him and saying, can we display your work at Lollapalooza? And he had these sculptures of like monsters, and it was people like that. I got to meet people like that, and I got to exhibit their work at Lollapalooza. And there were so many great bands there. And then afterwards, there were other shows at Molson Park. And one of the big ones was Soundgarden and Nine Inch Nails. And I had been friends with the same guy who managed Marilyn Manson, this guy Tony Sciola. He was involved in the management company of Nine Inch Nails. And so I was able to get Nine Inch Nails. And then I was doing shows with Soundgarden too, since they first started. So I went to Soundgarden and said, would you play with Nine Inch Nails? And somehow the sun and the moon all smiled, and the gig happened. It was a great gig, and that gig happened up there. But there were many gigs, and for a long time, people really enjoyed going up there until that era ended and another era started. But those were some good times.
Yeah, when it turned to Park Place, that's where things get a little funky, because it turned into, I always thought there's a book in there somewhere, because when Molson Park was Molson Park, it was the brewery was there. But then when Park Place, Molson moved out and Park Place became Park Place, that became the largest grow-op in Canada. Like, people were growing huge amounts of weed out of that place. And the three owners were three brothers or something. And one guy got caught, the other two are exiled to somewhere or disappeared. I think that'd be a fun book to read, is like the history of that place, because it was just so fun. And obviously what you're saying is such a fun and lighthearted thing, but like the there is a darkness in there somewhere that I don't know. It sounds like a book to me.
There was one time where there was this gig, Alanis Morissette was really famous at the time, and she could headline there. She could do 25,000 people. And her representative said, look, we want to make this a little cutting edge. Can you find some cutting edge groups? So I asked Dinosaur Jr. to play the gig. And so Jay got there, and he played so early in the day that as soon as he finished playing, he went after his rider and he started drinking it all. And he just got so wasted by like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. He was just like passed out on the floor. It was so funny. But Gallagher brothers were there. There was a show there with, like, there was Gallagher brothers with Oasis, Neil Young was playing, and then there was some other bands. There's like such good lineups that were out there. It was amazing.
I had a friend who was a production manager on the stage. His name is Biscuit. And he tells stories of they would wait. They'd say, let's go shopping. And they'd wait by the fence because people would drive up the 400 and throw all their booze over the fence into that forest part. And they would sit there in a golf cart and wait for the booze to come over the fence and then grab it all and then have booze. That was there. That was what they do. And there was that old hotel, the Holiday Inn, that you drive through basically the woods to get to and stay at that Holiday Inn. It was definitely a special time. That's sort of early to mid 90s, I guess. That's the time when it, to me, was the best.
Yeah, the Holiday Inn, there's some crazy parties going on there where all the fans would come and stay there. And it was early days for festivals, but they were really good. And it did seem like a simpler time.
Yeah. So you eventually, when did you end up moving south? I know you're not south now, but when was that big move and how did all that come together?
So it was around 12 years ago, and I had been living in Toronto and I had gotten married just recently, had a kid, and this company started, Golden Voice was happening at the time, and they were owned by AEG Concerts, and they had been putting on Coachella, and I had some friends who ran Golden Voice, and one time they came up to Toronto and they did this show with Limp Bizkit. They were doing the Limp Bizkit tour, and I went to the gig and I just wanted to be part of that. It was just I was a little tired of doing what I was doing, and I felt like I had kind of done it all, and I wanted to try to find some new adventures. And I started writing the owners of Golden Voice, Paul Tillett and Rick Van Santen, and saying, come and get me. I want to go work for you. I want to go to LA. I want to expand what I'm trying to do here. Cause it's just like, I tried to work with bands and do tours, like with the Beastie Boys, but I was just like this guy from Toronto, and it was hard to kind of get things done. Cause I just didn't have that much weight, and I knew I needed to try to get somewhere bigger if I was going to try to take the next step. So eventually I got hired and they said, come on down. And I left here and started fresh down in LA and trying to put on concerts there and learn about where the gigs are in LA and California and other places. And I eventually, you know, soon enough, I was booking. I mentioned this place before, this Long Beach Arena. It was in the southern part of just outside of like an hour or two away from LA and by the water. And it was this old arena and it held like 12,000 people. And it had this giant floor where you can just, everybody could stand on the floor. There weren't any rules. It was just, it was just really cheap place. So the rent was cheap and the bands just loved playing there and people went there like crazy. So I would do shows with like System of a Down would play two nights there. And AFI sold out there. Jimmy Eat World sold out there. The Foos would play two nights. There was one time there was the Foos and Weezer together playing two nights. Just so many good times, so many good bands playing there. That's where Rise Against did their headline show at the Sentences Fall Down. So I was able to do like really big numbers and quickly get into a bigger scene and I was able to compete with all the big guys down there in LA. And Golden Voice, because they were doing Coachella, they had a really good reputation. So I was in this place where I was amongst like-minded people such as myself who were really good. And it was just, we were definitely breaking all the rules. It was great.
Yeah. Gold Voice did come up in punk rock too, right? They, throughout the 80s, and were always putting on shows, you know. And Kevin Lyman was part of Golden Voice in a way, right?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, okay.
They had this house in on the Sunset Strip, and when Golden Voice was not owned by AG when they're first starting out, and they would put on all these great shows at the Olympic Auditorium in LA, and then in Santa Monica, at the Santa Monica Civic. So there was all these, if you go back, all these great posters of Black Flag. And the Gary Tovar was the guy who owned Golden Voice, and he used to bring in all the British bands. He was the first guy, takes so many chances and just creating a whole scene where there wasn't one before. And then Gary eventually went to jail for selling weed, and he had to turn the company over to Paul Tillett and Rick Van Santen. And while he was in jail, and they ran the company, and then eventually they started Coachella, and then they came and got me, and then Gary got out, and he's still friends with Golden Voice, and he's a friend of mine, and he comes to all the gigs, and he goes to more gigs than I go to. Just a wonderful guy, and just very real, very just always checking things out, always at Coachella, checking out 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He's there seeing all the new bands, and just always has so much enthusiasm for music. But if you go back and you look at his posters and how he started punk rock, he was one of the first ones to start all that.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a nice deep history with music and Golden Voice and Kevin Lyman, of course, starting Warped Tour. It's sort of like the punker rock version of Lollapalooza in a way, and doing that. The first Warped Tour show was in the Sini Grandstand.
Yeah, I did the first Warped Tour, and I remember doing it. It didn't have a name at the time, and just trying to just kind of do this, and we'll see how it goes. And I knew there would be skaters there, but you couldn't. It wasn't like you could say that a certain skater was going to be there. And it was like Helmet was there, and But what we got, like 4,000 people to that gig in Toronto and got it started. And with people like Kevin, they worked at Golden Voice, and they learned as they went along. And the funny thing about Golden Voice and Coachella is that when Coachella, as it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually doing shows with like Beyonce and Dr. Dre and all these, and the epicness of the whole show was put on by the same people who would earlier were working on the punk rock shows at the Olympic Auditorium with Black Flag. But those people rose with the business and with the bands, and they learned how to do it as they went along. And so that they learned how to take on the huge production. And there was this one guy, Kevin Wilkins, who's the major guy for Coachella for the production. And he started off doing that. He was working for Alice in Chains, and everybody's got tattoos there, but everybody like they didn't have to bring in the professionals to run Coachella. They brought in the same people who were doing it before. They learned how to do it. And I always looked at those people with so much admiration that they were able to like learn how to do this. And when Beyonce needed something done, they got it done.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I remember that first Warped Tour because SNFU, I think, played last on that. It wasn't necessarily a headlining show, but definitely that was like the moment where like, I think Sublime were supposed to be there and they couldn't make it across the border. Orange 9mm. L7, Quicksand. There was some good bands on that. And that was the main... Oh, No Use for Name. There was some like good bands on that bill. And there's a band from Germany called Wieso. And they're looking at the order of bands, and the guy sees SNFU. He goes, SNFU? In Germany, they're so little. I was standing beside Brent, and he was like, no, we play pretty big places in Germany. It was very... they're so little in Germany. but the Warped Tour kind of like, that's the tour that just always was sort of like two uneven wheels. And it was just like kind of making it down the road and kind of getting there and kind of getting, you know what I mean? Like I did a few of them I worked for Sum 41 in the early 2000s. And they were like one barbecue away from people starving. It felt like, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it gave so many bands an opportunity to play.
Oh yeah.
And so many bands an opportunity to travel from one place to another, that when the bands were so small, they only had a little buzz in their city, they got to go on tour with other bands.
Yeah.
And the democracy of the whole thing was great, where Kevin would take the names and put them in a hat and just draw them for that day. And
you have to be there at 9 a.m. to see what time you were playing.
Yeah. I mean, that was going back to the whole punk rock ethos. Yeah. And the way nobody was really making a lot of money on that tour, but they were having a good time. And if you would go behind the scenes and see what was going on, and like they were like throwing dice and getting high and
oh yeah,
just going trashing hotel rooms, and just everybody got to be the Rolling Stones for a minute. It was wonderful.
Yeah, that Green Day were on that tour, and they would always be like, and NoFX, Green Day and NoFX were on that tour, and Green Day would always play for an hour, and they're like, you're supposed to play for 45 minutes, and be like, oh, what? And just look at them like, no, we're just going to keep playing. And that's they'd light the drums on fire, push the bass amp over, and you know they were done. That was, and by the end of that whole, like what I saw, they had like 57s, like just $50 microphones for overheads for the drum kit, because they were just completely destroying gear all along the way. Yeah, it was a fun experience, especially with like a kid band, like Sum 41 at the time. They were like 17, 18 years old. It was their first real tour, you know?
Yeah, I remember doing Green Day, one of the first shows when they were popular, which was in Toronto at the Concert Hall, and Doughboys were on the show. And I'd asked the Green Day people to let Doughboys be on the show. And there just never so much arguing about who was playing where and how long. And just, there was definitely not the good part of rock and roll then. And a lot of egos involved, and just, yeah, sometimes it's sad. And, but yeah, it's funny times.
Yeah. Were you part of the Concert Hall show when I think it was Smashing Pumpkins during the Gish tour, and they got booed off the stage? Does that ring a bell?
Well, I'd done some early shows with Smashing Pumpkins, like at Lee's Palace and times like that. And then they kind of got big, and I worked with them later on. I don't know if I worked with them when they got booed off stage. I can't remember. But I wanted to mention to you that I when I was emailing you before, that group, Dirty Rotten Imbeciles, DRI, played at the Concert Hall. And I just remember, like, such a great band, such a great hardcore band. And I was saying that the singer wrote a book about he lived in a tree and he had no money. And it was in a park in wherever he lived. And he wrote this book about living in the tree for a while. And I just remember, like, just like such a great story. And yeah. You just, like, again, there's talk about character and rock and about all the different personalities that you've met and that I've met and that have been there over the years. And that's one of the great things about music, is that there is music and then there's also the personalities involved too. And there's like so many great personalities you talk about, but Ian MacKaye and what he represents and everything. And he's a very kind of quiet guy and he doesn't want to have his ego. And then there's other people who are full of ego, and then, yeah. And good for them, because that kind of
balance,
like Manson or Billy Corgan, they are like so larger than life, these kind of people, or L7. It's just like, it's wild. I remember there was this band called the Lunatics. Lunatics were a great band. And they used to, I had an apartment, and those were the days when bands would sleep at your apartment because they didn't have any money, and they'd say, couldn't we sleep at your apartment? And in the morning they would eat Fruit Loops or Cocoa Pebbles.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like just fun times with bands.
Yeah, I remember those days too, because in the early 90s I toured a lot in a band playing, and there would always be like the house you'd stay at, whatever city you'd go to. And I remember in Minneapolis, it was the THC house, and there was a guy named Chad, and he was in a band called Threadbare, and he gave me like early Jimmy Eat World demos, early Sensefield demos, like early stuff that hadn't made it to Canada yet. And I brought like a thing of empty cassettes and just started recording cassettes from him. And I think that's how the culture moved around pre-internet, you know, where we would, it was like you take tapes and you'd go to a next house and you'd stay and you listen to the tapes. But that's great. And then they copied from you. And that's sort of how the world worked in those days.
Yeah. And then from there, it would be the van, and the van would get bands from place to place, and they would live in the van, and they would listen to music in the van. And there's all these stories about, this is like pre-buses, about what you're listening to in the van, and just getting from place, because these drives are so long, especially in Canada. Some of these drives could just be endless. I talk about a band like Change of Heart and Rio Statics trying to go from place to place, and it would just be so long. And but I think once they got past the fact that they were starving, making no money, and everything was breaking, those moments were probably some of the best times in their lives.
Oh, yeah.
And putting the cassette on and arguing about what they were going to be listening to was probably amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a time we were driving up from Florida, and I played Jason Tate from Weaker Than's was the drummer from Red Fisher. And he always had this crazy eclectic style of music, but always managed to put like the right song on at the right time. And I remember listening to like Roy Orbison. We're listening to Roy Orbison in the dark. And I'm not lying. There was tears coming out of my eyes about like, oh my God, this song is so perfect. Like, how did you know? You know what I mean? Like, how did you know? And we literally drove from Florida back to Toronto because we had like two shows canceled along the way. Our van was like ready to die. And was like, I'll never forget it. It was like one of those moments like, yeah, that's what being in a van is all about. And understanding, you get to learn who people actually are. And I don't know if that really exists anymore when it comes to, I know in Europe, people still tour in vans. And I've never really, maybe it happens. I don't know. Maybe I'm too old for it. Maybe I'm too old to understand what happens with van culture.
Well, it was funny because you hear these stories about band saving up to buy the van. And then when they got the van, that was like, okay, where do we go next? We got the van. This is the big time. We're the Beatles now. And we got our own van, and all the stories about the different types of van, and people would give the vans names. And when Slow was playing and they came to Toronto with their van, then the van died when they got to Toronto, and that was it. And they lived like in my apartment and my friend's apartment across the street for like a month. And they were living in the van. They had no money. And when you talk about Roy Orbison, and you find that it's the context, really, because you hear about Roy Orbison or you hear about Dolly Parton or whoever, but in the right context, you can really understand why these people were so great.
Yeah.
And yeah, like Roy Orbison at night and on a lonely road and at 2 o'clock in the morning, he really works.
Yeah.
That's when you get the essence of someone like Roy Orbison. It's really amazing.
Yeah, that's when I was touring with SNFU, they didn't have a radio. So I bought a little tiny CD player that had two little speakers, and I was really into the first Sunvolt record at the time. And it's kind of like this, you know, wispy sounding sound coming out of the speakers. And I remember Brad going, this is the way it's supposed to sound, not like in high fidelity speakers. This is the way this record's supposed to sound, with tinny, bit shitty, you know what I mean? Like, and yeah, the context is everything, you know, you'll never forget that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think when the Kinks first started, the way they got the sound of the guitar was because Dave Davies had his amplifier kicked in somehow, and something broke and it exploded, so that when he was playing through it, and his brother heard it and said, "Oh my God, that sounds great!" And it was just because, like, yeah, I know, it's like it was the tinniness. And you're right. Like, I think with someone like Sunvolt, that their music, it should be like they've been traveling in the van for 12 hours and everyone's so tired, and that's the way his voice should sound, and that's the way the music should sound, and as if somebody had kicked in the sound system.
Yeah.
And it should sound tired. And someone like Jay from Sunvolt, he's not the most pleasant person. And doesn't suffer his fool gladly, and doesn't say anything. But again, that's like what these guys should be like.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be a Mr. Personality.
Yeah.
And that's why Sunvolt never became a big band. Like, Wilco got to be a huge band.
Yeah,
and they were both in the same band when they started in Uncle Tupelo. One band became famous, the other band's still playing for like 500 people a night. And but it doesn't make Sunvolt any less of a band. They chose to go on, like Neil Young would say, like, they chose to take the fork and they went in the ditch instead of like on the road, and they stayed in the ditch, and that's still fine because that's what they represent. I should also mention too that you mentioned the Weaker Than's, and I don't think there's a finer band in Canada to come out of Canada than the Weaker Than's, probably. Mm-hmm. Like, as far as what John Sampson, as far as the lyrics that he's written, and being like this university professor, almost like the Bad Religion singer, like Greg, like just intellectuals into rock, putting these amazing lyrics with like an amazing band behind them, and the all the people that, like the guy you mentioned, some of the other people in that band, and coming out of Winnipeg, and some of the songs that they were referencing Winnipeg, that playing in a vacuum and coming out of there, when you look back on the Hall of Fame, they should be like number one for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I lived with John Sutton, was my roommate in Winnipeg for a while, and actually replaced me on bass in Red Fisher when I moved back to Toronto. John, he's in Toronto now, actually. But when they mixed their Fallow album, they stayed at our apartment, And I almost got kicked out of our apartment because the landlord thought I brought extra tenants in, but there was like three extra guys. This is before Steve had joined the band. There was three extra guys staying in our apartment, so they locked me out for like one night. I'm like, God, they're just visitors. You gotta let me. Yeah, yeah. Good deep history with that band. They were the first band to let us my band open up for them in Europe. Been champions of, you know, they're just good guys. I mean, I like people who are, like you say, he's very intellectual, very smart. And I remember hearing all the early John Keith Sampson stuff in the Red Fisher days. There's a cassette he put out called Slips and Tangles, and there's probably three songs he just played with acoustic after he quit Propagandhi to put on this cassette that ended up being Weaker Than songs. Definitely, yeah, absolutely a hero of mine because he's just so humble at the same time.
Yeah, there. Red Fisher, was that named after the Red Fisher show?
Yeah, this the fishing guy. Yeah, yeah. There was actually who else was in that band? Well, Jason, myself, and then a guy named John, who I think he moved out. He started a band called Miko, late '90s, and then he joined the Black Halos for a little while, and he's out in Vancouver now. Yeah. There's been rumors of possibly a Red Fisher reunion, but there's like four other bass players that would have to play before me because I think I was the second last guy. Yeah. Before we forget my Sunvolt story, I was tour managing Voivod and we were in Boston in Cambridge and we were doing the Middle East Club. And around the corner is TT the Bears. And Voivod was playing at the Middle East and Sunvolt was playing TT the Bears. And I actually ran around and I saw Sunvolt play at that very small place. It's maybe the size of, it felt like a closet. But they were on a tour bus, which is strange because they were like pulled in a tour bus and played the smaller club. And we were in a van and played the larger club. And still nobody came to our shows.
Dark days. Again, I think that Voivod, again, if you talk about Weaker Than's being a great band, Voivod would definitely be one of the great bands coming from Canada.
Yeah.
And at one point, they had a minute there where they were the headline band and all these other bands were like the support band for them. Like whoever it was, like Faith No More or whoever other bands were. They were support bands for them. And then people like Away and Piggy and some of the other guys in the band, I just admire them so much. I remember when I first heard about Voivod and again, just thinking like, wow, what an incredible band. And there's bands like Rush and they became really, really famous. It's a shame that a band like Voivod didn't get some of the traction that Rush did because when you put the bands side by side, Rush gets all this, and deserving so,
yeah,
get all this like applause and accolades and everything too. But Voivod, they were musically amazing. Songs were amazing. All the personalities were great. They're live, they were great. So, and it's a shame that they didn't get to be a larger legendary band than they were.
Well, I think they got their due somehow. I think they got into this Canadian songwriter. Aren't they on some Walk of Fame now? I don't know. I just saw something that they were all dressed up, and Piggy passed away a few years ago. And the one tour I did with him, it was a different singer, bass player, and his name is Eric, and he looked like Sebastian Bach, and he's a tough guy to work with. But I have to tell you a story because it's around the we're at Call the Office. That sort of gives you an idea sort of where Voivod were in the era of where their rock career was. And Tony Lima came up to me and he whispers in my ear, and it's in August. He goes, Princess Diana has just been killed in a car crash. So I'm like, oh my God. He goes, you should probably tell the band so they can tell the people. So I go on the monitors. I go, hey guys, Princess Diana has been killed in a car crash. And Eric, not skipping a beat, goes, well, all right, this one's for her. This one's called Nano Man. I'm like, oh, okay.
It's a Spinal Tap moment there.
Very Spinal Tap. I'm like, dude, a little compassion, man. So are you back in Toronto? Are you visiting? What's happening? Are you waiting for this? You know, I'm not going to mention what we're going through right now because this is the first thing this year where we haven't had to mention that thing. So I don't want to start now because it's been an hour. We've been talking almost for an hour.
I appreciate it. I appreciate you having me on your show. And I'm in Toronto right now, and I haven't lived here in 16 years. So it's been great being back here and just being back in the situation where I'm able to walk around the city and not have to work too much and just kind of enjoy my time a little bit and just take on a different appreciation for the city has been really great.
Yeah. Well, that's good, man. You're one of the guys up there that I kind of wanted to talk to because you've been there, you've done it, you've done everything, and you came out the back end of it and you're still doing it. That's always like, to me, it's amazing that people can still do it and have a passion for it. It's commendable.
Yeah. Well, I guess if the passion would leave, then that would probably be the time to stop. But I'm always, all the time, ever since I was 25 years old to now, wake up thinking like, okay, what's going to be happening? What am I going to be working on? Who am I going to be chasing today? And I always make like a list, and here's the targets that I'm going to try to chase. And I chase them down, and sometimes people say yes, and sometimes people say no. But then sometimes you're just trying to think of some ideas too and go after the artist and say, I got this idea. And again, with Kraftwerk, I was doing a show with them at the Sony Center in Toronto, and I had got the manager was there, and I brought him this amazing poster that this guy did. It was a 3D poster, and if you held it one way, it showed something, and if you held it the other way, it had a different color, a different shape to a different story. Amazing poster that this guy did, and I gave it to the manager, and he looked at it and said, oh, this is incredible. And then I said, oh, by the way, I really think Kraftwerk should be doing more gigs in just like LA, Toronto, New York, a couple other places. And he said, great, like, here, let me go introduce you to the band. And I went in there, and I met them and showed them the poster, and the manager said that he has some ideas for you. And I mentioned, you should be playing this place. You should be playing Edmonton, Canada. And the guys just said, yeah, we've been wanting to play all these places. And I don't know what had happened, but they just said, like, put a list together where you think we should be playing, and let's do it. And I did it. And all of a sudden, the next time I was their promoter, and we were doing like 25 cities across North America, and it was in 3D. And the band got we were in their van because they flew, so they took you from the airport to the gig. And they said, "Oh, we love Canada. We love Edmonton. We know the skiers who were famous Canadian skiers because they ski and they know about, they live close to Austria. So they knew about all these famous Canadian skiers and how important they were. And so when they got to Edmonton, they were going, this is where they're from. And let's go to the Olympic track where the speed skating track and all this. So it's incredible that sometimes I get to live my dreams, and it goes from me just walking around thinking about these things to actually making them happen. That's the best part of it.
That's amazing. Well, that's a good way to end it, man. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and, you know, let's do it again. I mean, this doesn't need to be like a one-stop shop. I'm sure there's a lot of stories buried in there somewhere that can come out eventually.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for doing these podcasts.
And that was Mr. Elliot Lefko. That was a good one, right? That was great. Yeah, it was great to talk to him because, like I said, we've known each other on and off for throughout the years. We'd see each other in the hallway. We'd put our hand up and say, hey, I know you. I know you. That's all we knew. You know, it turns out we've kind of worked some of the same gigs throughout the 90s and possibly 2000s. Elliot Lefko, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it. And Merry Christmas to everybody. Today is the 28th. This is probably the last episode for the year. We get into the new year. Go back to weekly, I think, for a little while, and get our act together, get up that 300 mark, see where we go from there. AXDSP.com, get the intuitive compressor, links in the description. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to this podcast week after week after week. New Year's is coming up, and we got to get out of this dumpster fire of a year, get into 2021, and new American president, hopefully a vaccine on the way, health and happiness for everybody. Happy New Year, everybody. We'll see you next year, 2021, for a brand new episode of this podcast with yours truly and someone else talking about things, possibly old guy stuff. Love y'all. Bye.